Hi, my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the Psalm TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am talking about a book entitled The New Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia, written by Tom Stevenson and edited by Orsi Szentkirályi. I am not entirely sure how to pronounce her last name. I apologize for that. So what to say about this book? This is by far physically the largest book I have reviewed this season. And by that, I mean it is literally 12 inches by 10 inches by 2.5 inches. I think it might weigh 10 pounds. It is, I think they call this a tome. It could be a doorstop, and it is described as essential reading for both the Master of Wine and Master Sommelier examinations. And that's a strong flex. As a Master Sommelier, I've done a lot of studying and reading and preparing, so let's see if this is in fact essential reading. This episode is brought to you by Sparklers, the new cooking and wine pairing competition show, which just premiered on Psalm TV. Centered around champagne and sparkling wine from all around the world, all 13 episodes star a cast of food and wine professionals who are changing the culinary world. While the show is guest judges, the main challenges are judged by the five contestants themselves, pitting friends against each other as they make tough decisions to create one of the most unique food shows you've ever seen. So a little bit about the author, Tom Stevenson. He actually is someone whose opinion and thoughts on wine I certainly very much respect. I technically have met him once. He is a British wine writer, wine critic, and wine judge. He's written a bunch of books, not just this one. But one of the books he's probably most famous for is his Christie's World Encyclopedia of Champagne and Sparkling Wine. I own an edition of that. He has an opinion, as many writers and critics do, but it is a very, very helpful book on champagne and sparkling wine. Y'all know I love champagne and sparkling wine, but can't have all of the books I review be about champagne and sparkling wine. Or can they? That's a question for my producer. But this book is unique. So this book was published in 2020. This is not the first of its kind. This is actually the most updated version for the first time since 2011. And one of the reasons I was so interested in trying or wanting to read this book and check it out is that I own a previous edition of this book. I checked the inside jacket, which, by the way, my previous edition is smaller, not by much, but by like an inch or two in dimension. So the book has gotten bigger over the years, just in dimension, and we'll see about content. I owned the previous edition, which is the fourth edition, published in 2005. There have been some other editions in the meantime, and this one is the most recent update since 2011. It is 765 pages, not including the index. And I should also mention that this book is published in collaboration with National Geographic. So I grew up with that as a magazine with like amazing travel stories and beautiful pictures. And this book is chock full of beautiful pictures and maps and all of the kind of things I like. But I think in the day and age that we are in the world of wine, I wonder if this book can live up to its claims. The reason I say that is because this book encompasses, well, it says that it encompasses everything that you need to know for both a novice and a collector. And I'm not a collector, but I do know a lot about wine. I'm definitely not a novice, and I do have wine at home. I just am not it's not a transactional situation where I find myself buying and selling and trading wine. But it does encompass most of the aspects of the wine world. They say from history to culture to geography. This edition includes information about wines, 108 different growing regions, vintage charts, which is actually a pretty helpful thing, a key guide to up-and-coming producers, region-by-region highlights of wines around the world, and much, much more. So I cracked this beautiful book, and one of the first things I notice, actually, once we get past the foreword, is the first thing that we come to is a small section entitled Understanding the Fine Wine Market. And it should be known that this is the Sotheby's Wine Encyclopedia. So Sotheby's Wine was established in 1744, and it is both a retailer. They have locations in New York and Hong Kong, very famous auction house with locations in New York, Hong Kong, and London. And then they also offer storage in New York, Hong Kong, and London. So in the world of fine wine, as it were, they are a major player. So what is fine wine? Well, they actually tell you, for the purposes of this book and for this chapter about understanding fine wine, quote unquote, fine wine is defined as a wine that costs more than $50 US per bottle, is highly allocated, has aging potential, and is in demand in the secondary market. So that means whoever originally purchases it might then put it on the auction. And that's an important consideration for Sotheby's. That said, I don't know what percentage of the people who buy and consume wine around the world actually are aware of or participate in the secondary market. So I feel like this was an obligatory inclusion, but when it's the first thing that you'd come to, if you were, I don't know, studying for an introductory or certified sommelier exam, and this was the first thing that you saw, you might be like, is this book for me? It's just a thought. And there is some interesting information, and I find wine auctions quite fascinating. Certainly some of the books that I have talked about detail them, but it's an interesting way to lead off. It details things like a boxed out section with Sotheby's most valuable single owner sales. And that's like kind of gross wine trivia. I mean, people's sellers, including that of William Koch in 2016, valued at more than $22 million. That was his wine cellar. Just the wine. Yeah, the contents of that wine cellar. So there might be some stuff in the very beginning that is interesting to you, or you might just keep flipping pages until you get to part one, taste and quality. And this is an interesting section. So I look at this, and I should mention, and I know I have before, but in case you're tuning in for the first time, thank you. But in addition to working in the wine trade, I also teach wine classes. I teach WSET classes, which is another globally recognized organization, not the Court of Master Sommeliers. And after completion of all the levels with the WSET, you can apply to the Master of Wine program, the Institute of Masters of Wine. And there are lots of people who contribute to this book. The majority of them are Masters of Wine. That program requires writing, so it's not surprising to see more Masters of Wine, though a few Master Sommeliers, European in location, did contribute to this book. So the beginning is, I think, maybe geared more towards the novice. If you didn't know a lot about wine and you wanted to spend $75, it's a big expensive book, on a beautiful hardcovered book about wine, you might want to learn what determines, you know, taste and quality of wine. And this is actually stuff that we cover like in our WSET, like level two classes, and it's things like location and climate. There is an important distinction, and I smiled when I read it because I talk about it every time I teach those classes. It distinguishes the difference between weather and climate. And basically, climate is the aggregation of the weather. Weather is what happens every single year. It's what gives us different vintages and vintage variation. But there are certain characteristics in certain growing areas that are somewhat consistent year in and year out with regard to sunshine, annual precipitation, humidity, etc. And all of those aggregate over time details create the climate, whereas weather is individual. So I kind of love that that's included. They talk about aspect. So grapes are oftentimes grown on hillsides, and the direction that the hillside faces is really important. If you are far south in the southern hemisphere, you want a north-facing aspect because that will maximize exposure of the grapevines to sunlight. So pretty straightforward stuff, right? Well, in the section on climate, I'm not going to lie, I was a little bit surprised. In this day and age, and this book was published in 2020, when we talk about the climate, or as politicians say, climate, they don't even preface it, one of the things that we often hear about, scientific fact that everyone who grows grapes knows about, is climate change. It is a huge thing in the world of wine and the world generally, but we know that climate change is a critical phenomenon that over the past, you know, few decades, and it was interesting to see this in a book I reviewed last season about vintage Champagne, with vintage charts and descriptions of the vintage each year and when the harvest dates happen, you can see it just in the data that conditions are changing and temperatures are warming and grapes are harvested earlier every year. But climate change doesn't just mean that temperatures are getting warmer. It also means that weather patterns can become more erratic. So things that can affect the quality of a vintage, like a hailstorm or, you know, strong storms that can create devastating floods, these things are all more frequent. If it seems like we hear about more devastating tornadoes and hurricanes on the news every year, that's climate change. And I was really surprised that it wasn't given any discussion in the section on climate or its own section, period. In fact, I thought maybe I missed something. And so I flipped to the index, you know, fast forward 765 pages, and there is one reference for climate change in Italy, one reference on one page. So there's not a section in this book that details with that. And so on page, you know, by page 20, where I got to that, I thought, ooh, that's a missed opportunity. If this is the ultimate guide to the world of wine, which they say that in all capital letters, early on, I think there was a missed opportunity. We'll leave it at that. There are lots of cool kind of compiled bits of information, whether it's vintage charts or lists of producers in particular regions. And there's a guide to vineyard soils. And, you know, if you're a rock jock or a dirt nerd, like this might be interesting to you. And it's several pages long. And it's the name of the soil and then a description and sort of why that might be, you know, good or bad or what its characteristics are. But I will say, there's no pronunciation. There's no phonetic pronunciation guide to it. And these different types of soils exist all over the world. And sometimes there are, I mean, if you like puns, like I like puns, and you like wine, so you like wine puns, then this is a fun, you know, a fun thing that you can pun on. There is a type of soil that we find frequently throughout Austria in the Wachau region, among others, and it's pronounced nice, like make it nice. It's spelled G-N-E-I-S-S. So if you did not know how it was pronounced, it looks like Gneiss, right? And so I feel like already by page 24, another missed opportunity, especially because this book says on the inside dust jacket that it is created for novices. And if you are just learning, this is a great resource, all these different types of soil, but you won't know how to say them. And I don't think that would have taken too much more effort to put in there. So just some initial observations. And this is not a podcast harping on missed opportunities, but I flagged a bunch of them just in the very beginning. And I think it's because I'm so dialed into teaching these wine certification classes where we talk about viticulture and vinification. And I also think about one of the things I love so much about this podcast is I like learning, and I like all these different books that I read, and I learned so much from them. And this book does a very good job of aggregating a lot of that information together in one place. But one thing that I learned relatively recently is different types of viticulture. And I should, I'll elaborate on that. So when you're learning about growing grapes and making wine, the three major styles of viticulture that we often talk about are conventional viticulture, which is, for lack of a better terminology, it's kind of like old school. It's what's been accepted for a long time. It allows you to use whatever synthetic herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, fertilizers you might want. It can lead to a monoculture, which is not great, but the idea is it maximizes your growth and potentially your profitability. However, in the recent times, we recognize that all those chemicals, glyphosates, they are not good, right? They'll actually give you cancer. And if you are consuming this agricultural product, the fermented juice of these grapes that are being grown, perhaps we care a little bit more about what, you know, how they are actually grown. So then we start talking about maybe sustainable viticulture, which isn't really mentioned here, organic viticulture, or biodynamics. And I've talked about them before, and I don't necessarily think that I need to rehash them here, but I was sort of hoping and thinking, and there is, by the way, one of the most famous, look, put a pin in what I was saying, one of the most famous associations with biodynamic viticulture, which is a practice that pays attention to the phases of the moon. And it's, some people think it's a lot of woo and like kind of, well, Tom Stevenson calls it airy fairy stuff. I mean, whatever, he's a British wine writer. They use funny words and phrases. But one of the practices that's oftentimes described in even brief write-ups of biodynamic viticulture is when the viticulturist or wine grower will take a cow horn and fill it up with a mixture of manure, like dung. Basically, they bury it in the vineyard over the winter, and then they like dig it up and they like take out that manure and they like basically make a, you know, a slurry or a tea with it, and then they spray it all over the vines. And I've read a lot about it. A lot of stuff makes sense, but there is a very big, very juicy, colorful picture of someone's hands holding two manure-filled horns. Mmm, yum. it's a little more moist than you usually see. It really looks like someone took a big poop in a horn. But you know what? Nature's dirty. And so it's good to see this kind of stuff. And actually, there's one paragraph on sustainable agriculture, but there was an opportunity missed yet again for a new style of viticulture that I've just recently learned about, probably just within the past year and a half. And because it's new, and it's called precision viticulture. And when I reviewed last season the book that Pedro Parra wrote called Terroir Footprints, he's like a terroir hunter. And this is one of the things that he uses. He digs soil pits, you use soil hydrometers, you might employ drones, but you're basically using a lot of really high-tech information to gather data and then use that data to tailor your interventions, if any, in the vineyard very specifically, plot by plot, row by row. And so it doesn't ascribe to like a holistic idea. It's just very high tech and very detailed, hence the term precision viticulture. And that's something that I've been hearing more and more about. And there's pros and cons to it. It's expensive, right? So you need somebody, you need all that information. You need the hardware and the software, and you need somebody who can interpret that data. So it's not necessarily for everyone. And it maybe is best suited towards smaller to medium-sized producers rather than large industrial producers. But I was surprised in a brand new book, so all-encompassing, that that wasn't mentioned. We teach about it in the W set. And so I expected to see that, you know, here, but again, I did not. So I'm not going to just harp on all the missed opportunities. There's actually some great information. So the first part of this book is very much kind of a primer on the beginning of, you know, basic information, illustrations of how grapevines can be trained, a whole section called The ABCs of Grape Varieties. By the way, this book is written by a British author, so you know it's always correctly utilized the term variety as opposed to varietal. They're used correctly whenever they are used. But this ABCs of all the different grape varieties is awesome. It includes notations whether they are white grapes, black grapes, and also if synonyms are used, because one of the trickiest things in the world of wine is that a grape by any other name, it might be the same. So the best examples I can use are like Tempranillo in Spain. It's like the great red grape of Spain, right? But Tempranillo has like 7 different aliases depending on which region it's grown in, because it can mutate, it can develop different characteristics. The Tempranillo that we see in Rioja is genetically the same grape as Tinto Fino in Ribera del Duero or Tinta de Toro in Toro, but they do elaborate different characteristics. And to be correct, we would call them by different names. So it's important to have synonyms. But like the soils, these names of these grapes don't have pronunciations. And I harp on that just because the podcast that I recorded previously in this season about godforsaken grapes did include phonetic pronunciations. So, you know, if you only have 2 books, those 2 will accomplish the goal of understanding these grapes in this section. So as we move through the beginning of the book, and I'll come back to some of these things, the book tackles things like producers who make different barrels and their names and their descriptions, or different types of wine glasses and the different brands and how they might be, different types of wine openers, food and wine pairings. There's a lot of information in this book, 765 pages of information. But the real heart of this book, at least 3/4 of it, is a detailed kind of journey through the world of wine, country by country, region by region. And this is a big book, but the first country, not surprisingly, is France. What was surprising to me is how big the section on France is. Now, look, France is a very important country in the history and global production of wine. It's not the only big, important historical country in the global production of wine. But I was so fascinated, and the detail's great, don't get me wrong. Each section, and this is consistent throughout the book, the way these sections on countries and regions are located, or how they're organized rather, is a little bit of history, a glance in terms of the different appellations or whatever term for an appellation might be, general production statistics in terms of like cases produced or what percentage of the total regions or countries production a region might account for. There are maps. There's usually some interesting pictures, maybe of bottles or things like that. And then, for example, I'm looking at Burgundy, and there is a little snapshot or a little boxed out section with recent Burgundian vintages. This book details no vintages beyond 2018, which makes sense because it was published in 2020. But that is just important. Some wine producing regions make wines that aren't meant to be aged. Some make wines that have to be aged for years and years and years, but that's as far as we go. There is also a more comprehensive vintage chart in the back of the book. And then there are, within each region, little detailed information on all of the different appellations, factors that might affect the flavor and taste and quality of wines from that region. And then there's also a producer list. So there is really a great deal of information. But man, I was like, wow, France is covered exhaustively. So I started keeping track, right? And the section on Bordeaux was 71 pages, which doesn't seem crazy, right? And then I get to Burgundy, and Burgundy's just 24. All right, well, I mean, we won't even delve into the non-egalitarian treatment of Bordeaux and Burgundy, but I started counting, and France accounts for 211 pages of 765 pages. So it's more than a quarter of this book. And that's not a problem, except for when you start to look at other big players. And even if you are a novice in the world of wine, besides France, I think it's fair to say that Italy, Spain are also big players in the world of wine. France gets 211 pages. Italy gets 45. Wait for it. Spain, 25. And it goes down from there. So this is a very Eurocentric book, but it's very French forward. And France is, I can't say it enough, very important, but there are places in the world that are famous, historical, fascinating, and diverse. And from a sheer real estate standpoint, they do not get the same kind of coverage as the classified growths of Bordeaux. I don't know why I said it that way. I sort of felt like I had to. I was very excited when I got to the section on Champagne, because again, y'all know I love Champagne, but I know that Tom Stevenson knows Champagne as well. And there's great information on here, but there's also some stuff that kind of like raised my eyes. or my eyebrows, I should say. And one of them is like, actually, let me see if it even labels it as, yes, there's a section called Current Trends. This is dangerous, right? Because this is a book that is new, but it's only been updated once since 2011. So I was like, oh, what are these changes? If you have been following along or you also love champagne, these are things that probably make sense to you. The rise of the grower champagne producer, the Heuqueton Manipulant. No big shocker there. The lowering of dosage. This would also be a good opportunity to talk about climate change, because dosage is either the additional of sugar and wine at the end of the champagne making process is used to either create balance in the wine or to make it intentionally sweet. Intentionally sweet champagnes represent a very small fraction of the market. So mostly it's used to add balance to the wine, and especially because these are very, very acidic wines, a little sugar just makes them more harmonious. Almost every wine grower I've ever talked to or read their words about champagne is that dosage is lowering, not just because of current trends and preferences for dry wines, but because with global climate change, the furthest north region of wine production in France is historically a cool climate. And so you would have underripe, highly acidic grapes that would not be pleasant, and they needed more dosage to balance them out and make them more delicious. As temperatures have risen with global climate change, it is easier, everyone says, to achieve greater balance in the vineyard, which is what we're always looking for, right? And so you don't need to add as much dosage to balance out. And so I thought that that would be a good idea to talk about that there, but it's just, it says that this is an approach that's been trending amongst younger producers. I'm not sure if that's true. And I'm not sure if that refers to more recent producers, but I know some team old guy wine growers in France and they're still lowering their dosage. So, but he's a critic, right? And so his opinions are going to start coming to light. And I'm familiar with some of his opinions, having read his book on champagne. So the next trend after dosage is his words, the cult for oxidative champagnes. That's a strong word. Now, oxidative is a style of winemaking where it's basically the opposite of reductive winemaking. So in reductive, you're trying to prevent and protect the must in the wine from exposure to oxygen. It creates certain flavor profiles. And with oxidative winemaking, there's a little bit of exposure and there's benefits to both of these, but they do create different styles. I like good wine. I like good champagne. And I like champagnes, some of which are reductive and some of which are oxidative. Calling it a cult is, that's shots fired almost. Certainly there are people who get real, like they want to like wave the flag for the style of champagne. And I have definitely tasted some that taste like cider and they are like oxidized and not delicious. And they're not for me, but I also stand by my words that the world of wine is big enough for all of us. And if it's your jam, like fantastic. It's not mine, but calling it a cult, I thought was strong. He talks about rosé, and one day rosé champagne will no longer be looked at as a trend, but it is just historically in terms of rosés that have been produced, it is relatively recent. We didn't really see prestige rosé champagne until the 20th century. So that is a relatively recent trend. Here's something that I thought was really interesting. Proliferation of clear glass bottles. So there is a phenomenon, and let me just read what he says. He says, any wine in a clear glass bottle exposed to artificial light, or by the way, real light, for 60 minutes starts building stinky light strike aromas. This 60 minutes can be accumulative, and in sunlight, it's much quicker. While many of champagne's competitors have quickly learned that clear glass bottles are a false waiting to happen, the greatest sparkling wine appellation in the world is willing to sacrifice its hard-earned reputation because the marketing people want these bottles for blanc de blanc and rosé cuvées. Any chef de cave or CEO who uses marketing as an excuse to overrule quality should be sacked. Oh no, you did not. So let's explain. I have said before, I represent the champagnes of the Moët Hennessy portfolio as my day job. And one of those champagnes in particular, Ruinart, sells a non-vintage blanc de blanc in a clear glass bottle. It is beautiful. It's delicious. And that's how I learned about Light Strike. And I learned about it because the chef de cave at Ruinart, Frederick Paniotis, who's like a genius and I think would make an excellent spy for other, you know, additional reasons, but he's really smart. And one of the things that he is known for pre-COVID, and hopefully we'll be able to return to this, is teaching and lecturing about very technical aspects of winemaking. He shares his knowledge generously. And I learned all about Light Strike from a lecture from Frederick Paniotis. And it basically, I won't even try to summarize it here, but the light waves will react with, I believe it's amino acids, and it ends up creating these very sulfuric, stinky aromas in the wine. So imagine, and I love cauliflower. It's one of my favorite vegetables. sauteed cauliflower or roasted cauliflower, whatever. One thing you can't do with cauliflower is after you've cooked it, stick it in your fridge and then try to reheat it. If you've ever done that, you're going to regret it because it's stinky. It's gross. It's the same thing with Brussels sprouts. Cruciferous vegetables just don't really respond well to that. And that's kind of what it smells like when you get light strike. And there's no saving it. You cannot fix it. And so we talk about that with Ruinart. That's an important part of our training, is that they like the fact that you can see this beautiful 100% Chardonnay wine in a clear glass bottle. It's atypical. Most champagne comes in a green glass bottle, which protects it. It blocks those the light waves. And so what we have always taught and what we preach is that while you can't fix it if it goes awry, let's do everything we can to prevent it. So for years, Ruinart would only sell bottles of their Blanc de Blanc in the clear glass bottle to the off-premise, to retail stores, if it was in a gift box. And the box protected the bottle. So I would always tell people, if you go into a store and there's a bottle of Ruinart Blanc de Blanc and it's not in a box, don't buy that bottle, right? You just don't know. Again, this is a little inside baseball because I represent, you know, these wines, but one of the most exciting innovations that Ruinart, and this is not a podcast about Ruinart, the wines are great, that they came out with is trying to be more cognizant of their carbon footprint, is eliminating the gift box because it's a lot of packaging, and creating a new type of packaging that mirrors the shape of the bottle. It's made from paper pulp. It's called Second Skin, but it covers the bottle, and you can put the bottle in a bucket of ice and it doesn't dissolve. It completely protects, but stays true to the unique shape of the Ruinart bottle and mimics the texture of the Crayère, the chalk pits in which the wines are aged. And so they're doing all this cool stuff to be more environmentally friendly and to protect the wine from light strike. But you can also look at this beautiful, like, little jewel bottle of champagne, and I think you can accomplish all of those things. There's stuff that will go wrong with wine regardless. And I think that they're trying to be as proactive as possible and also shine a little pretty spotlight on the fact that their wine is really pretty and their bottle is really unique. But to say that anyone who's doing that should be sacked is fighting words, right? It's especially funny because when we go a little further on in the champagne section, by the way, there is a big, beautiful picture as I flip through of the Prestige Cuvée from Louis Roederer, Cristal, which also comes in a clear glass bottle. It has an orange cellophane wrapper, but it is really funny because as we get into the producer profiles, of course, Ruinart is mentioned. And so I thought, that was a little bit of a shots fired at Ruinart because they weren't mentioned in the part about light strike. But when I was reading the write-up of Ruinart, it's just a little paragraph. These are very succinct and small little write-ups. But under Frederick Paniotis, the chef de cave since 2007, this entire range has freshened up and the non-vintage Blanc de Blanc has become one of the greatest Blanc de Blanc in the world, with or without a vintage. Fred's main task is now to bring intensity to the Dom Ruinart Blanc de Blanc and go on and go on and go on. There is no mention of the clear glass bottle or the recommendation that he should potentially lose his job because he chooses intentionally to keep the wine in that bottle. The entire range is recommended by Tom Stevenson. So I just thought it was funny. And I love sharing anecdotes. I mean, that's the privilege that I have with the experience and the knowledge that I have, but also the job that I have is to apply that and look at that with, you know, a critical eye when I'm looking at these books. My only experience meeting Tom Stevenson IRL was a few years ago at a wine conference called Texom. And I think he was probably on a panel somewhere and I've attended as a volunteer and hopefully when things improve, I'll be able to go and speak. But I was, I think, working in a room as a volunteer for a tasting and he was in there and I had a question about something in champagne. I can't actually remember how I started the conversation, but I am me. And if there's someone there who I want to meet and I have a question for, I am a very bold question asker. I'm a fervent learner and I want to know. And so I was talking to Tom Stevenson, champagne expert, and he started talking to me about a process called jetting. And this is an innovation and this is really interesting. And it's a little blurb under the innovations category called jetting and the mitic or the diamic corks. And jetting, as it's written, can either expel all oxygen before the cork is inserted into the bottle, guaranteeing the identical and also minuscule amounts of oxygen in every bottle, therefore eliminating or controlling oxidation and ensuring consistency of post-disgorgement development in champagne. He doesn't explain what jetting is. And I remember asking him what jetting was. And so what he told me and what I've further gone to look up is it's this process used in champagne that once the bottle has undergone its élevage, it's aging on the lees, it has to be disgorged. So it's riddled, it's clarified of its yeast. And typically during that aging time, the bottles are sealed up with a crown cap. But once it's disgorged, champagne by law has to be sealed with a cork, a real cork. And there's this little bit of headspace. And so there's a micro amount of oxygen. And corks also allow a small amount of oxygen ingress. But particularly for certain styles of champagne or just consistency generally, you want to minimize that. And so jetting, what it does, it's a mechanized process. And it basically at a very high speed shoots a micro droplet. And I don't know the volume, but like not like a eyedropper droplet, like a micro droplet of water at a very high speed into the neck of the bottle. And that causes the foaming reaction in the wine. I mean, it's not even a milliliter of water. It's a teeny tiny amount. It's a fraction of that. But just the disturbance of that little bit of water causes the bubbles to rise up in the neck to the top of the bottle, and then they can insert the cork. And so the bubble formation up the neck of the bottle pushes any oxygen that's there out, and then they put the cork in. So it's super technical and it's super cool. Real life practical application. Here's where this is cool. So that was a couple of years ago at Texom. From the goat's mouth, you know, goat like greatest of all time, I hear about this process. And look, I passed the Master Sommelier exam. It took me 5 attempts. I have passed theory each time. Tasting was the thing that was hardest for me. I love theory. I love learning about it. And while I do not write the exams, I have personal experience taking the exams. And I do remember taking theory a few years ago. And one of the questions that I was asked about was jetting. And I knew what it was because like earlier that year, I had met Tom Stevenson and he explained to me the process of jetting. And I say this a lot. Theory comes alive. And it's so dumb, but theory does drive everything in the world of wine. Understanding the who, what, where, when, and most importantly, the why is so critical. And so I just thought it was so neat that I, you know, have spent years studying for this wine certification exam. Part of the community was volunteering at this big wine event. I meet this famous author and expert. We start talking about innovation and something technical that I didn't understand. I wanted to learn. He taught me. And then I was able to use my new knowledge as one question of many, many, many questions on an exam that, you know, was an important part of my journey. So I love seeing that there. But he didn't explain what jetting is in the book. Tom, you're killing me, Tom. So I thought that was kind of interesting. As this book progresses, I will say that the chapters on subsequent wine regions do get smaller and smaller, but it does include some areas that are definitely, I don't know, up and coming. He's a British wine writer. So English wine is covered here and probably with more detail than you'll find anywhere else. There is a vintage chart for wines of Luxembourg. There is a vintage chart for Swiss wines. There is a section on China, India, and Japan. It's 3 pages, so it's not big, but I don't want it to sound like there is not incredible, deep, interesting information in this book. There is. It's just, there's kind of a mix of emphasis or the amount of emphasis that are placed on different areas. I love maps. I've drawn a lot of maps for myself. And so I do really appreciate these updated maps. I will say, I think one of the dangers is that, well, I'll talk about it when it comes to my review, but the world of wine is always, always changing. And that's just one important thing to think about. I did encounter at least one error in this book. The wines of Germany, Austria, and Switzerland are all lumped together in one category, which is maybe sad. I know I've talked about recently that the wines of Switzerland, they produce way less than a lot of their neighbors. Most of it's consumed domestically, so there's less familiarity. Germany and Austria are pretty prolific. And I know that they share a language and their borders have changed over the years, but come on, man, can't they each get their own chapter? Like, that's just not cool. But I did notice as I was looking through Austria that there was a vintage chart for Swiss wines. And I thought, that seems out of place. And then as I flipped forward to the section on Swiss wines, there was a chart on Swiss vintages. So somebody's copy editor missed that little teeny tiny detail, but the information is still there. So we might be missing a couple of Austrian vintages, but there is a more comprehensive vintage chart in the back of the book, which kind of covers everything. And if you want to deep dive into wine producers of the British Isles, or you can flip through this book and encounter most major kind of wine growing regions. I do think that one thing is kind of funny is when you get to the section on North America, specifically the United States, there are a list of all the different appellations. And one thing that's pretty funny is even if there isn't an AVA, different places are included. So like, I thought this was interesting. I used to live in Washington, D.C. for 10 years. And as we go through kind of state by state and the appellations that exist, the AVA's American Viticultural Areas within each state, it seems odd that there is an inclusion for DC because A, it's not a state, and B, there is no AVA there. But John Adlam, the author of America's first book on winemaking, tried unsuccessfully to persuade the federal government in the 1820s to support a national experimental vineyard with every variety of native vine in existence to ascertain their growth, soil, and produce. Jefferson had tried and famously failed. This would be Thomas Jefferson, our fourth president. And now Georgetown, this area of DC, is just all restaurants, hotels, and lawyers' offices. Huh. I mean, there's no AVA there, but there was an attempt at some point to have a little bit of a historical kind of nod to our native varieties. I mean, interesting. You learn something new every single time. There are some additional things that I think this book could benefit from. In the beginning, there is also a section on, I mentioned like food and wine pairing and glassware and openers. And the opener section is really important. I mean, we often think about just, you know, a corkscrew or something like that, but there are other elements with which you can open a bottle of wine. This book details the Coravin, which is, I've talked about it before in my series Study Hall. And Coravin is this amazing technological innovation that allows us to access a bottle of wine, but also preserve it without pulling the cork. It is too recent for this book being published in 2020, but one of the big innovations this year is Coravin, after many, many years of development, launched their sparkling preservation system. I've tested it out myself. They, I should say, are an official partner with Moët Hennessy's champagne portfolio. I had nothing to do with that, but that's a really new innovation. And it's so new that the book doesn't cover it. One of my favorite tools is actually something that isn't included in here. And it's like a twofer. It's called a Durand. And it's this great tool that combines the helix, like a corkscrew, with something that's called an osso, which you may have seen. It's like a little handle with two flat prongs. And you rock it into a bottle that's sealed with a natural cork. And then you can turn and pull it out. The name comes from the fact that when you show people how to use it, allegedly, they go, ah, so that's how it works. An osso. And a Durand is this really neat contraption because as wines age, the corks also age and they can become really crumbly. And depending on the style of wine, you know, high alcohol or sugar content can certainly aid in the degradation of the corks. And so just sticking in a regular corkscrew and popping it out, you might actually just punch a hole through the cork or it might just crumble. And so to have both the helix of the, you know, the corkscrew and the side support of the two prongs of the osso is actually a really great tool to extract corks, older fragile corks from older fragile bottles of wine. And it wasn't in here. And I got to think that the Durand is available all over the world. I'm not sure where it's produced or manufactured. I love it. I think it's a really important innovation and it's kind of low tech. It's not computerized. You don't need any other accessories. It's a little bit big for your pocket, especially if you are, you know, having to buy women's clothing and they don't put, you know, usual pockets in women's clothes, but it is a really good kind of low tech tool that has great utility and it didn't make its way in here. The section on food and wine pairing, it's a little bit of a joke. I love food and wine pairing. And it's, when I say it's a little bit of a joke, I just mean that like vast cultures like Asian cuisine are lumped together. And then there are kind of like traditional and budget style pairings. And while I believe that champagne goes with nearly everything under the sun, that's like the go-to traditional pairing for just Asian cuisine generally. And then like oftentimes the budget pairing might be beer or sake. Sake could actually get very, very, very expensive. But it's very, very Eurocentric, I notice with the food pairings. And kind of old-fashioned. I don't want to sound ageist, but the food pairings are a little old-fashioned. And then I noticed some overlap with descriptors for tasting notes. And part of that is a British thing. Just there are differences in vocabulary. But when I sort of stepped back after those sections and took a look at this book, I started to make some conclusions. So I think it's important to, you know, start to wrap it up and talk about what works in this book and what doesn't. Well, when it comes to what works in this book, so much. There is so much information within these pages. The pictures are gorgeous. The writing is very, very good. There's boxed out information with like fun facts and tidbits. I mean, it's not a humorous book, but there are funny English terms in here. There's great quotes. There's lots of contributing writers. It is content dense, right? So there's great information. It is a well-written, important reference text. As for what doesn't work, it is very Eurocentric. And it's not just in the focus on the countries and the regions it focuses on. I mean, I already said that more than a quarter of this book is devoted to France. But the food pairings, the descriptors to use to talk about wine, it's just all very Eurocentric. And I realize this is a very new topic in talking about wine. because Vitis vinifera is a European grape variety. So understandably, wine growing culture, much of it is, for lack of a better term, rooted in Europe. I'm sorry, I can't stop. But the world of wine is getting bigger and more diverse every single day. And consumers of wine aren't just from Europe or of European descent or English speaking. And I've talked about this with my good friend and fellow Assam TV cast member, Shakira Jones. And we, you know, everybody has a different experience when it comes to talking about wine. And the vocabulary you use is shaped by the foods and the smells and where you grew up. And this book, if you are just getting into wine, the vocabulary that it gives you is real Anglo-centric. And that's, it's okay, but it's not encompassing. One last thing that I will throw in there is I just take note of this. Most of the pictures are just of landscape or buildings or bottles, but there are plenty of pictures of people in this book. And I'm not just talking about winemakers. The winemaker is who the winemaker is. Put a picture of them in there. But there are plenty of pictures of consumers or hands holding glasses of wine or hands pouring bottles of wine. And it's largely white male images. And I do think about that just because if this book is the end all be all tome for someone who's learning about wine, I do believe that if you do not see your image reflected in something that you're trying to learn about and assimilate, then it might not seem like it's the thing for you. And there's just a lot of images of white men. I mean, there's some women in there too. It's not a huge part, but it's just something I notice. Maybe 99% of the people who read this book wouldn't notice it, but I turn a critical eye to that because if it's just a hand holding a glass of wine, why not have an illustration where it's a blue hand or have all different kinds of colors of hands? All the colors of the rainbow, my friends, put them in there. It's a little thing, but it actually is a big thing. So what is my rating for this big, heavy, beautiful, funny, dense, interesting book? I've thought about this long and hard. And one of the things that is mentioned several times in this book, even right now as I'm looking at the back jacket, whether you're looking to become a master sommelier or simply want to advance your personal wine knowledge, you'll turn to this comprehensive, authoritative, and elegant book again and again. I mentioned that I previously had a copy that was published in 2005, and there isn't a required syllabus or reading for the master sommelier exam. It's certainly a valid criticism of the exam that there isn't a syllabus. It is self-guided study. And that's the big challenge, right? I didn't use this book as I was studying for my exam. And partially it's because the previous edition was published in 2011 and I attempted theory for the first time in 2014. 3 years is not much time, but the world of wine moves fast, very fast. And I did actually double check on the Court of Master Sommeliers website. And the only place where there is actually recommended reading is examples of references for the certified sommelier exam. And this book is one of a dozen or 15. Now that list of references hasn't been updated in a few years. And so I think it's important that this is a really good reference text. It is not required reading for the MS exam. And there shouldn't be any kind of confusion about that. Because it is so comprehensive, but also even though it's the brand new edition, there's still not stuff in there. My rating for this book is actually a beware. This is the first time I've given that rating this season. And there's no quota. I don't set out picking books, thinking about how I'm going to rate them. In fact, I was really surprised how much I loved all of the books that I picked. And I, you know, these are books I hadn't necessarily read before. And this is a great book. I'm giving it that rating for several reasons. It makes some broad claims about being like the essential guide. But I think the problem with books like this style of book, it's less and less common these days. More of what we see are specific region or topic focused books. And when you're getting a little bit more granular on the subject matter, you can be a little bit more up to date. So my concern with this book and why I say it's a beware is that yes, the information is good and it's well-written and it's beautiful. This cannot be your only source. And you must recognize, and you might not, if you don't listen to this podcast, if you didn't listen to this podcast, but bought this book, that even this book, comprehensive as it is still missing some pretty big and modern information. And whether that's an editorial choice or a timing situation, the danger with these big, kind of generic is the wrong term, but expansive reference texts is that they can't cover everything. They simply cannot. And by the time a new edition is published, there will be so much more information that you might miss. Like I said, climate change, not discussed. If you didn't hear this and you were studying for the MS exam and you didn't know what jetting was, and you did not talk to Tom or listen to this podcast, it's not something that's widely discussed. So I hope that justifies to you all why I say that this is a beware. It's not because it's not good. It's because it's so big and the world moves so fast that there's a greater risk, I feel, with a book like this becoming not obsolete, but out of date more quickly. And it's a significant financial investment. Also, this takes up a lot of space on your bookshelf. I think there's actually like Kindle versions. I'm old school. I like real books. I like turning pages. And this, for lack of a better term, is a big ass book. And it takes up some space. So it's not something that you can just easily tote around. But if you are petite and you need a booster seat at the table, you can sit on this one. It'll raise you up a little bit. So weird recommendation. I hope it makes sense. I really, really like this book. It's just a caveat emptor determining my rating. So let the buyer beware. Thank you, Tom. I hope if I cross your path again, we can be friends. I do think this is a really good book and I have learned a lot from him. Just put it out there. And I think it's unique also that this is really a true reference style text. And I haven't really covered one of those yet this season. So I like to mix it up. Anyway, I hope you all enjoyed what you heard today. Please subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a rating. Tell us what you think. Got some questions? You can hit us up at Tom TV or on social media. We will be back next week to wrap up the season. Talk to you soon. This episode was brought to you by Sparklers, the new cooking and wine pairing competition show on Psalm TV. Centered around champagne and sparkling wine from all around the world, all 13 episodes star a cast of food and wine professionals who are changing the culinary world. While the show is guest judges, the main challenges are judged by the five contestants themselves, pitting friends against each other as they make tough decisions to create one of the most unique food shows you've ever seen.